Next on the Uncomfortable Podcast with Jeffrey Gabriel, we have domain name Shane Cultura. Come hear Shane's stories touching on being a stock trader, bartender, botanist, TV personality for a national TV show, domainer, marathon runner, a father, and maybe, just maybe, even a domain broker. Here, Shane and I talk about managing employees, motivating employees, selling domains, email deliverability, bad domain investments, the state of the domain industry, taking the big leap to do your own thing, and we both agreeing that the number one secret to both of our success is our support system at home, starting with our wives, our families, and then our friends and our colleagues. If you want to be a guest on the Uncomfortable Podcast, have an idea for an episode, or have some feedback, send us an email to buzz, B-U-Z-Z, at saw.com. If you're listening on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, or anywhere else, please, at the very least, give us a like. It helps our rankings immensely. And as always, thanks for listening. Today on the Uncomfortable Podcast, you have Shane Cultura, better known as Domain Shane in the domain investing world. Shane is one of the founders of DSAD, DSAD.com, that puts out a daily list of domains at auction from auction houses from around the world. He has put out a list every single day since 2009 and has missed less than 10 in that period. Shane owned and ran a nursery and garden center for 28 years while he pursued his domain investing on the side. Shane started running at 40 years old and has run 35 plus marathons, two Ironmans, and is now pursuing 100 mile races. We're definitely going to talk about that. Shane is the original Get Uncomfortable. I guess I'm the plagiarizer. And as that has been his motto for over 30 years, and I can agree is mine as well. Shane retired from the nursery business in 2023 and is now pursuing domain investing, domain and brokerage, and his other hobbies full time. Welcome to the show, Shane. How are you doing today?
Hey, Jeff. Hey, great. I'm glad you had me on. It's I've been watching it, and I was hoping someday I'd have the honor of coming on, so I appreciate you bringing me here today.
Yeah, I'm honored to have you here. You know, I put on my Red Sox hat because I want to forget about the NFL season of 2023. I'm a Patriots fan, so pitchers and catchers for the Red Sox report in 2 days. So I thought I'd put this on as some lucky juju. This is my lucky Red Sox hat. I actually was wearing it. It looks a little weathered. I was wearing it when I sold sex.com. So
It looks like a multi-million dollar hat.
Yeah. I'd be like doodling on the insides and hoping for the best, you know, when these are happening. So hopefully there's some positive juju here.
Yeah.
Anyways.
No, I have my lucky swag too.
So there you go. So, you know, I like to start with pretty much everybody on the show and find out about their business or their personal lives and things like that. So let's quickly go over, you know, you and the planting business and then how you found domains, got in the domain business, and then how it kind of brought you here. And then we can kind of start talking about the industry and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people in the industry know my story, but I can say it quickly. I didn't know what I wanted to do out of high school. You know, my family has a nursery business since 1865, and I worked doing that through high school and, you know, my whole life. That's how I earned money, is working for my dad doing that. But for five generations, everybody's done something else and then come back to it. We all do it. We all hate it. We go and go to college or go to war. I was actually the first generation not to go to war, which I'm very thankful of. But I definitely didn't want to go back in the nursery business. Like, I had unloaded enough trucks and known how hard a work it was. I wanted to do something, quote, better. So I went to college, University of Alabama, where my dad went to school. And I ended up doing really well at the USA Today. You remember USA Today paper? They had a stock picking contest that we did in a class. And I think I was top 10 in the country. And my professor said, hey, you're pretty good with numbers, and got me a job at the Board of Trade, actually the Chicago Options Exchange in Chicago. So I left school and was a trader. I moved up from runner to pit to kind of doing the whole thing until I was one of those people in the pits with the hand signals doing that. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this the rest of my life. And long story short, during a Federal Reserve meeting, I held a position that my backer, so a guy gave me $1 million, I had to pay him 80% of the profit. I kept 20% of the profits. And I had a couple rules. There weren't very many rules, but one of them was no big trades during big meetings. Well, I made a big trade during a meeting and I did very well. I think I remember making a couple hundred thousand, but he walked out there and took his money away from me and said, there's rules here. I don't care if you make money or lose money. There's rules. And if you don't follow them, I can't have you as, you know, I can't put my money in you. So it was a big lesson to me. Yeah.
What year was this? Sorry to ask.
I was in the early 90s. So this is in 1994. Yeah, 1994. Okay. And it was a lot of tears, you know, a grown man crying because getting someone to back you took a long time to get. I was being risky. You know, it kind of set the stage of how I was going to act in life. I wasn't scared of risk. I was aggressive. I loved money. I love action. I loved buying and selling. I loved buying low, selling high. I was doing $50 million in trades a week as a young 20-year-old. And so it kind of set up early that I loved those kind of things. But fast forward, my dad noticed I was kind of hurt and said, I have an idea.
Come to the nursery.
Yeah, he said, I'm thinking of leaving my dad's nursery and forming my own thing in a college town in Champaign-Urbana. And I didn't want to go to the small one in the family. Like, there was no way I'm moving to the small town. But Champaign-Urbana seemed like a nice college town. I love college towns. There's youth and sports and all kinds of things. So I had met my wife at the time. She wasn't opposed to it. And we moved here. And my dad and I started with like 3 employees. I told the story a million times. I did more on a Friday my last year than I did the whole year in retail sales. So we did more in one day than we did the entire year. So we're doing $5 or $6 million of stuff we grow ourselves. And I had a great life. That's a beautiful life. Growing plants, you know, you're going to hear me tell all these analogies of plants, but life is like plants. It's patience, it's growing, it's trimming, it's calling out the bad ones. It's just, life is all about growing plants. And it taught me so much about that. And then, you know, not speaking too much, but it kind of led me also to realize a business owner puts all their money back in the business. Your best investment is yourself. And so when you make money, you don't go invest it really in the stock market. You take it and reinvest it in your own company because you know what you can do with that money. So that's well and good. But what it turns out is when it's all said and done, all your money is in your company, which is a great company and a very profitable company. But every bit of profits goes back into expansion because we kind of talked before the show, you learn when you have a lot of employees and children that it's not about you. Your decisions affect everybody. My goal started to be a good business, but your goal eventually, I have 48 employees and 48 families and 48 people with children. I have to provide for them. Every dime I have has to go back in there because they want to make more money. They want more opportunity. They want to move up in their lives. And the only way to do that is for me to create that. They're not going to create that. They're going to be good employees and learn, but they're not going to create that opportunity.
Yeah, they have their own hopes and dreams and goals of their own. And they're working with you. Like, one of the things I think people forget when they have employees who work for them is that those people are working for you voluntarily. They're not required to come to work tomorrow and they're not required to do anything for you. And they can quit at any time they want. And so I try to remember that. Some days I'm mad and I make mistakes and say things I didn't mean or whatever. Yeah. But like, you know, going back to that is providing a place. You're right. They're 40 families. They're 80 kids if they all have 2 kids, you know, and their wives or husbands or other, their own plans and their own hobbies and their own vacations. And I agree. You're 100%
right. And they should want more. But the problem is they want to take a step up, but it's my job to make the step. It's my job to create the step that they can step up at. And so, or step it up somewhere else. If I don't do a good job, they're going to step up, but they're going to go step up to a competitor, to another business. So I would love to keep them around. So that became my responsibility. And as you know, with 48, you know, there's hierarchies, but you talk to everybody different. There's some people that a loud voice inspires them. There's other people where maybe an arm around the shoulder. You have to talk to every single person differently to inspire them and get them to go. And that becomes brutal. So I have my wife I talk to away, my daughter I talk to away, and then probably 22 other people I interact with daily that I have to remember how to interact with them. And as you become older, that becomes harder. It really does. As you become a middle-aged man, it's hard to talk to a 22-year-old woman in a way that drives them to become better. So I acknowledged all that, and I became probably worse at my job after 50 because it was such a diversity of employees and how. And so you start stacking people in the middle to talk to them, and people don't think about that. But I thought it was more difficult, maybe because I had more people.
I was managing at one point over 50 people at Uniregistry, and I feel like in the beginning of it, I think I had a harder time, maybe because of the years of doing it. But now that I'm getting older, I find it easier to manage people because I think I might have a little less testosterone and more understanding and patience with people than I did before. And I think that comes with age. Talking to a 22-year-old and relating to them, whether it's a guy or a girl, I don't care. I think that, yeah, you're right. I'm 20 years removed from that now. So she's having challenges I've never had when I was in my 20s, or he had. But I think personally, having that patience is something I have that I didn't have, you know, before.
No, sometimes
I'll write a mean email and I won't send it. And I'll let it sit overnight, where when I was younger, I'd been like, fuck you, and I'd send it, and you can't take it back, you know?
No, and that's the rule on emails. Yeah, there's nothing going out at night. No text. That's the other thing, is all text will get copied and pasted and put on social media.
I actually don't send anything.
I'm only on the phone just because of that. But I agree with you. It's just everybody, that's the other thing, is motivating people is so individual. Like, what motivates one person versus another? And again, I do become better at that, but I do have to learn that John really likes his time off. Like, I can't motivate him with overtime and money and time and a half.
Yeah,
he actually prefers, that doesn't matter to him. He would rather have the time off. So, okay, well, I'm going to manage his schedule. And the other person's like, I don't ever want to leave. I want to make as much money as I can. So if I don't give them overtime, they're pissed. So anyway, that's kind of where I was. And I think I did a really good job, and I definitely grew, like you said. It just became so, so diverse and so big and so many responsibilities that people will say I micromanaged. What I did is I laid out the hierarchy too flat. I was so sick of 80s middle management. I hated how many levels there were in the 80s in businesses that six people had to report to each other, that I flattened it out and it became a little too flat. So I had too many people reporting to me once I got really large. So
you also end up with way too many chiefs and not enough Indians, right? At that point.
Yeah. And I think I had the opposite. I had a lot of Indians and I was the chief of all of them, and I couldn't. It's just too much. Yeah.
And it's too overwhelming. Yeah. And delegating is hard sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a good lesson. I'm a better business person. And so, you know, getting back to domains, when I talk to someone, no matter how big their company, I kind of understand what they're going through. It may have more zeros, it may have more employees, but business is business. It's all the same. It's product, it's service, it's employees. And so when I talk to somebody about domains, if they want to go into the business side of it, I got you. Like, I get where you're coming from. I understand that side.
Let's go back real quick. I want to ask you a quick question about when you risked this guy's $1 million and then he fired you over it. Do you think 20, you know, 30 years later, right?
Yeah.
You're in his shoes and you had a kid with, you gave $1 million to, and he did that and it was you. Do you think you would have fired yourself, or do you think what he did was harsh or over the line?
No, he is right. I don't know about firing, because I didn't really have any warnings, but so it's not like if you do it again, but I do feel like I should have known that those were his rules. And
well, was that the cardinal rule? Like, that's the one thing you don't do?
At the time, I didn't know it was the cardinal. But I do know he was pretty set in his way. He was literally one of the first people to ever trade Black Scholes model and options. He opened the Chicago Chicago Options Exchange. He was a legend. So it was an honor to have his money. I went to dinner at his house. But You know, I no, I don't doubt. It was dumb to do. The funny thing is, to this day, when I hold trades through the Fed meetings, I still get nervous. Like I do it now. I still trade during Fed meetings, and all I can think about is like, this cost me millions of dollars before, because that same trading group, the next year, nobody made under $1 million. Like nobody. Oh. They all crushed it. Yeah. And I was making $18,000 a year.
Yeah, but that's a real burnout job, and you just don't know where that could have taken you. You could have made millions, 100%. But had a horribly unhealthy lifestyle and on your third heart attack right now. Like you just
yeah, no, I had definitely a drinking problem, like everybody else in the pit. We all had gambling problems. It's like a fraternity with billions of dollars. Like
yeah,
it's the craziest. And my wife just said, she was already at the time, she was my girlfriend, she was already giving me signs that this lifestyle was not going to last long, because I took a job at a bar too, just for extra money and to meet people. I didn't even need it, but I would go, this is how hard I worked. I would get to the office at 5 a.m., trade till 2, close out my books from 3 to 5 and relax. I'd go to the bar at 6 and I work from 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. at the bar, and then get up and do that again. Like, days on end, 1 hour of sleep.
How can you do that?
I don't know. It wasn't great.
Extracurricular inhibitors, maybe, to keep you going here and there.
But the money was so good. I won't bore the podcast, but the thing is, I would work the back door of this bar, and it was the most popular bar in Chicago. And the line every night would wrap around the whole building. And so the line would go around the building to this door, and everybody would knock on the door. Can I come in? And I started realizing I could charge them $20 to $50 to let them in that door and avoid the line. So I would make an extra $1,000 a night cash by letting people in that back door. And so I kept the job. Like, I didn't really need the job, but when it was so lucrative, and finally the owners came up to me and said, Shane, are you taking cash to let people in the back door? And I said, yeah. And they're like, that's brilliant. Split it with me. So they let me continue to do that, and then I split the money. But every night, my wife will tell you the story, I'd come home exhausted, and I would just lay all the cash out on the counter, just all the money. And when I would come home from work, my wife would have it all almost like ironed and laid out. And I knew I had a good woman, because she had that money perfectly managed, stacked, hidden. She was my money manager, and she's been my money manager for 30 years ever since.
Wow. So how did you end up? So you did the nursery for a long time, and then you started. How did you find out about domains and that opportunity? It seems kind of strange.
Yeah, so it sounds like it, but a serial entrepreneur, right? So I've always been doing things on the side, but as a business owner, you know that money goes back into the business, and you're only going to get a certain amount of salary. So I always wanted to do something on the side, and the internet came around, and you know, I'd been on the bulletin boards doing auctions since 1984. The old modem would go on to the phone, would fit onto the modem, and there was a bulletin boards, and you would do an auction. Like, it would say, I have a Star Wars Boba Fett condition 9, high bidder is Sven 64, and then somebody else would make a bid. And I would just keep doing that auction, a visual auction, and whoever won would mail me a check, and I would mail out the toy, and they would give me a rating. I did that since high school with Star Wars toys and toys. So the internet came around, and so on the side, even in the 90s, I started buying domain names, buying plant names, because I figured maybe we're going to sell plants on the side. So I bought, you know, Schilling was way ahead of me, because he was literally just going through the plant dictionary and registering names. But names that he didn't get, I would register those plant names, like boxwood.com. Any plant I saw in the nursery, anything related to the nursery that I thought was an item, I would buy. So I did that on the side. But my real money maker was this story that we just had about the trading. I wrote a blog called Wall Street Fighter, and everybody wanted to hear my trading stories. They just wanted to hear what I did, what I spent money on, working at the bar, the women, the alcohol. They love those stories. So I'm like, I'm going to blog that, because, you know, these other blogs are writing about things that are, I think, boring. So I wrote this blog, and I built it up to 1 million readers a month. And so it got bought out by Lionsgate Films and Break Media for a good amount of money. And I realized, okay, I can write a blog. I know how to monetize the internet. So I'm going to buy more domains. That's when I decided, like, that was in 2007, 2008. That's when I realized, okay, now I have enough money to start buying good domains and buying and selling domains. So I bought that money and I put them into domains that actually made me money. So I've been doing it since the 90s, never really made much money. But when that Wall Street Fighter sale came through and I got that big check, then I had the experience that we all talk about, like not just jumping into domains. I had the experience with domains, but now I had a little bankroll. So that's when it all started to me.
And then what was the first domain other than that blog that you sold for a profit? Because I call that more of a website or a business.
The first big one was boxwood.com. I sold it to, I saw that it doesn't resonate, but I sold it to a British or a UK-based computer company. For $10,000.
Yeah, so that's a great name. Yeah. Good brand.
It is a good name. I just hand registered boxwood.ai, just trying to bring it all back together. I was like, if I can sell it once, I can do AI in my second go round. But yeah, so that was the first big one.
Yeah. That's a good one. And what was like your very first when you're like, holy shit, someone's offering me some money for this?
That's the first one that somebody actually paid five figures. The rest of them were more parking like everybody else, right? Like I wasn't as concerned with, you know, I wasn't concerned with selling the domain as I was trying to get revenue in. Like I didn't think about the big sale. Like at the time when I first got started, I was thinking the big sale was a name that was generating good revenue. I wasn't looking at it like we do now. I was looking at it as an asset that that yields. Not as an asset that multiplies the yield. So that was a change for me. Once I started doing that, a lot of people that know in 2007, I became the 4number.com king. Like that's what I first started with. As I said, numbers are universal. And I couldn't afford three numbers at the time. So I was buying every four number I could for $500 to $1,000. And I just bought them and bought them and bought them. And I flipped them a little early when they became 20,000. But I did very, very well. I mean,
so in like 2015, how did you do? 2014, 15 is when the Chinese market exploded.
I was mostly out of it. I did well there because I had some portfolio, but I had sold before the big rush. So I definitely lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in potential, but I had already moved on to other names that have done fine for me. So no, I didn't kill it in the Chinese. I mean, I did fine. I think all of us did pretty well because of the four-letter.coms. Remember the four-letter.coms, if they didn't have a vowel, became just money. So, it was good. But you know, we also were doing six numbers. Like we got a little crazy during that period of time.
Oh, but, yeah. There's a lot of people holding the bag.
Yeah. No, that's, and I did on, I'm famously on .ws. I tried doing, and I still own some like two letter .ws's. And, you know, I look at a lot of things as why not? Like, just like the people did the .ai 4 years ago and spending that amount of money to renew for 4 years. And some people, thousands of domains that weren't selling for 3 and 4 years at 50 plus a pop. I did that with some other TLDs that didn't quite work out. Like I still don't understand why .cc hasn't become crypto, but it is what it is. Yeah. You know?
So what are your feelings about .ws? Because I remember when you were pushing it and then a group of people bought some, and I don't invest in a lot of domains, but I think I own like five or six of those right now.
I'll have one for the rest of my life because I bought Christmas.ws that had a 99-year renewal. Remember when they did those?
Yeah. So have you sold any of those or have any action on them whatsoever?
I have sold some two letters for $2,000 a piece. So I have them all priced at $2,000 and I've sold two of them. Has it covered me? I highly doubt it, but I'm down to like 5 2-letters and 5 2-numbers.
Yeah, that's about right.
But it is what it is. And you know where we went back, we got here through risk. We all came in here doing things that people didn't think had potential. And I've never ever told anybody to do what I've done. My entire time, anybody that knows me in this industry, I share everything. It's only to show my journey and to journal, and you can follow along if you want. You can learn from my mistakes. You can learn from what I've done well. I just talk about it because I don't think I'm doing anything to hide. Like, there's nothing that I do that I feel uncomfortable about doing. If I can't tell you about it, I shouldn't have been doing it, right? Like, if it's something that I can't put on Twitter, then I shouldn't do it. Now, personal, I get. As far as personal is different. But I'm talking about, like, you know, if I'm doing something that's proprietary, I get all that part of it. But I mean, as far as just our journey and what we're doing is where I'm headed with that.
Oh, I agree. Well, it leads me to a question I wanted to ask you about was with DSAD, where you put the list of auctions and then you point out names that you like on those lists on a daily basis. And as an investor yourself, why are you drawing attention to names that you probably want to bid on and that it ends up costing you money in the end if you're attracting attention?
I've never felt that I put anything up there that wasn't going to get discovered. Domain investors are way too smart nothing gets passed. I talk to these guys daily. They have way more tools and they're going to find everything. Nothing's getting through these auctions that they're not going to see. Mine is only a reminder to maybe there's some newer investors. I just feel like it's not costing me that much. I really don't think so. Because the person that I'm bidding at the final and going bidder 17, 18, that person was going to be there regardless of my list. That's how I feel about it. I really don't feel that I'm that special. I don't feel that my list is changing. I think it's getting some eyeballs on some names that they wouldn't have seen. And I'm not just selling myself. I think for the auction houses, it does help. It only takes one more bidder to run it up. So for that side, that is true. But I'm not buying that many domains, right? I'm buying domains that we're probably going to get there anyway. I was concentrating on the higher end names. I wasn't going through closeouts. So when I show a closeout that I think is good, it's really not costing me anything. I'm starting to do more closeouts, so it's probably costing me a little now, but I'm just not worried about it. Like, I'm going through the list. I'm doing it anyway. Why not write out a list? Why not chronicle what I'm looking at every single day anyway and making a little money doing that? That's kind of how I've looked at
it. Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, so like today, Speech Bubble was one of your top ones, right? And I feel like an investor who sees that, it would have been on their radar anyway, because my tools tell me that that term is searched 33,000 times a month on Google. So that is on the top of every investor's radar. But at the bottom of the list or in the middle of the list is like a random threeword.com, and it doesn't have a lot of search, but you can see that it's a term that might be up and coming, but it's going to take a little bit of work to find it. And I think that you might bring those to the top and let people know about those, that compared to the other 5,000 that look exactly the same, that's exactly the same. But you're saying, look at this, and then I would spend the time, and then that's when it probably could cost you.
Yeah, it's probably more in the lower end names, that like the closeout ones that I put out there. And I do think I built up enough reputation. There are some paid listings on there, right? There's some people that ask me to put names on the list, but they're all paid listings because everybody up there pays me to list. There's NameJet. I work with NameJet. I work with Dynadot. I work with DNWE. I work with all those companies to provide visibility to their companies. So I say that right up front. I always make that very clear.
Yeah, I saw it on the site.
I want people to know that. But at the same time, I have freedom to put anything I want. They're not telling me to put any one name. It's just for visibility.
Yeah, but I mean, if you were making all bad picks and it was all trash, like,
you're not coming.
No one's going to read it, so it's pointless. You know, they're looking 100%. At the clicks and things like that.
Yeah, and we track everything. We track every name to see who, like, it helps me build a better list, right? So I can see what names get clicked on the most. And that lets me know what names people are looking for. Like, if I put like a .net, just making it up, if I put on a net and it's the number one clicked one, I'm like, well, people are looking for more .nets than I assumed. So I can learn from the clicks on which one people are going through. So it's been great for me to learn more about the names to go through every day. And I have Josh and Travis helping me now write the list, because it does take me a couple hours. People like Josh and Travis, they don't put out the words, and the words are stupid a lot of times. My comments generally make no sense, and I'm having fun. I don't know that they add value. But to me, that's just how I've always done it. That's just me, and so I'll do it the way I want, and I enjoy doing it. And but it does take over an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on the thing, every single day. And I have a life. I was already working 60 hours at the nursery, doing my own domain thing for 10 hours. I do lots of activities. So my week was 800 hours. For 28 straight years, I got up at 4:30 and went to bed at 9:30 with no TV or stopping in between kids and family. I did that for 28 years. Nobody could keep up with me for those 28 years.
You're a machine.
It was ridiculous. It was a bit much. Once I retired, I look back and like, I don't know how I did it. Once I stopped, I don't know if I could do it that. But, you know, again, we talked before, working, you know, putting in the time is not the problem. Like 40 hours a week is vacation now. 40 hours a week over 7 days my goodness, I can do anything.
But it sounds like you're channeling that energy now into running. Right.
Well, I've always run 50 miles a week. I just did it at 4:30. Now I can do it at 6:30. Like that's when I ran this morning.
And then go for run.
That's the difference. Is now I get 8 hours sleep. I didn't have, and I'm not exaggerating this, I didn't have 30 minutes of REM sleep. That means dream sleep for 20 years. For 20 years. I never had a dream. I did not remember a dream for 20 years. I never had a dream. And I'm not exaggerating. Ask my wife. Never had a dream. Once I retired and started sleeping, I have these vivid dreams. I've never had those before. No, I mean,
were you
I
drinking?
Had them. I never drink. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say never, but it's, I just,
because when I drink, I usually don't dream. Yeah. When I drink, I don't.
That's
because
you're not getting your REM sleep. Yeah.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Not getting the right sleep.
I've dialed it back a bit, and now I'm getting very vivid, memorable dreams again. So.
Yeah, I get them now. Now I have to wake up and decipher what's real and what's not. Like I literally have to sit up and think, okay, what is true and what isn't, because the dreams are so real. But before that, I'm sure I had them, but I never remembered them. And my latency, you know, the time between getting in bed and going to sleep, never over 2 minutes. It was under 2 minutes I was asleep. That's
wow,
how fast.
That's annoying. Yeah. That'd make me angry if you're next to me, because it takes me a while.
My wife would just, that's the running joke. She's like, she'll go brush her teeth and I'll say, I'll wait up for you. And she'd just laugh because she knows by the time her teeth are brushed, I'm out. Like
you're done.
But
that's great.
But that's my life. Everybody's got their own life, right? Like I enjoyed it. I have no problems with it, but hard working is something that I feel very comfortable with.
So you're going to do something, or you're training to do something, that I physically think you would probably have to push me across the line in one of your nursery's wheelbarrows, is training for a 100-mile marathon.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was at the gym today on the treadmill doing a very brisk walk/jog, and I did like 2 miles, and that was at, you know, the steepest it could go, and that was enough for me. And then I could probably run, you know, 2 or 3 miles and probably collapse and then be, you know, cramps all over for the next few days. So how do you even get past the, you know, all right, 26.2 mile marathon, now I'm going to multiply that times 4. How do you even get to that level of even fathoming it and then attempting it and training for it and not hurting yourself horribly while
doing it? That kind of leads us to our uncomfortable, right? That's why I own uncomfortable.com, which I will forward for this show so we can all see it. But,
there we go.
Yeah, it's all about understanding. You have to teach your body to be uncomfortable, right? So our body is very protection. Everything, it protects us. If we get tired, it puts lactic acid in our legs, so we slow down. If we can't catch our breath, we pass out, so we start naturally breathing. It's made to protect. Your feelings, your emotions are all to protect you. So the only way to get past that is to slowly introduce it to things to teach it that you're going to be okay. So that's the process of training Your process of training is not just straight cardiovascular health and in shape. That's part of it. But it's teaching your mind and your body that I'm going to hurt a little bit, but please let me go on because I'll be okay. Like, it's just going to be a little pain. I'm not going to die. So introducing that day by day, year by year, will teach your body. That's when it can get dangerous, because of the point where it won't stop you anymore. Like, it, you will die because it doesn't stop you at any, you'll get to a point where it doesn't stop you for anything. You literally can, you know, run yourself into dangerous situations of overheating and things like that. But anyway, so that's the man in all this is Aaron Wilkins. So DSAD is Domain Shane and the Accidental Domainer. His name is Aaron Wilkins. He had a blog called The Accidental Domainer, and we combined them. But he wanted to travel. He didn't want to write every day. He had things to do, and he is an ultra marathoner. He doesn't do small little ones. He's done all the best races. He's done Leadville 100. He's done Moab 240. He did a 240 mile run. This past year, he did Mont Blanc 100 miler, New Zealand.
No, wait, the Moab is 240 miles nonstop.
Yes. And he did it. He completed it.
Yeah. And is that terrain, I'm guessing, in a...
All over, hilly. So there's tons of elevation. So that one has, he'll correct me, but I think it's 30 or 40,000 feet of elevation gain and another, and obviously the same coming down. The one I want to do is 17,000. Pardon me?
Do you have to do like a pit stop to change your shoes halfway through, or like,
oh, you know, there's a lot of pit stop. It's 4 days. You have to change clothes, you have to change shoes, you have to eat. I mean, yeah, you're constantly trying to stay alive. Yeah, I mean, he'll tell a story of passing out in a parked car that he found because he thought he was going to die. And then he got some rest and got back going.
I got to meet him for the first time at the ICA.
One of my favorite people in the whole world. Yeah. Great domain investor. He's great. We hiked. That's the thing is, he's taught me a lot about, you know, this. And he always told me, one day you're going to not want to run so fast. You should try ultras, because ultras are more about walking the hills and pacing yourself. It's kind of like life. At some point, you're not going to be able to sprint everything, and you're going to have to take things a little slower and do things a little different. And that's kind of where I'm at. I broke 3 hours in the marathon 2 years ago. You know, 6:48 pace for a 53-year-old is good, but I can't go any faster. I can't go any faster. Like, that's as fast as I'm going to go. So what do I do? I've already done Ironman. I did Ironman. My first triathlon was an Ironman because I was like, those guys can do it. I can do it. And then I did it. And I came home and my wife said, that's pretty good for someone that didn't train hard enough. And I was like, damn, it's on. So I did another one to see if I could do better. And I did. But then I thought the same thing. Like, how fast can I go? I can't go much faster. So anyway, we have a place in Leadville, Colorado, that's great training. It's a home of Leadville 100. I'm going to, in the mornings, put in the hours, and on the weekends, put in the hours, and then work during the day. So that's what I love about domain investing. I think all of us do, right? All of us love that we can work the hours we need, and it's really not consistent. You know what I mean? Like, the emails aren't just flowing every 5 minutes forever. You can answer emails when you answer emails. You can talk to customers when you need to. When you have a meeting, you can set those in advance. You don't have to take instant meetings. So you can plan and be flexible. Many jobs cannot do that. It can be from anywhere. So I can live here now. I can go to North Carolina 1 month. Nobody knows, nobody cares. As long as behind me is a Zoom and I can have good internet connection, I can do it. So that's what I love about domaining, is an opportunity of a lifetime to be able to do that. So I want to do everything but help Mrs. Havisham pick out a blood good maple that died last year on Sunday morning. I saw the first Saturday in my yard in 28 years. I'd worked every Saturday. If I didn't work it, I was out running a race or doing something with friends. It was never at home. I sat at my home. Or saw my daughter, like, you know, with kids, you're an Uber, you play every, I've watched every sport that a young woman could ever participate in. I traveled to see that. So if you give up your time on the weekends to go away from your business, it's for somebody else. And
it is. You're absolutely right. And it's not for me.
That's That's how it is. So when I sat here the first retired Saturday, I looked, I literally cried a little bit. Like, it was amazing. Like, a beautiful Saturday to work in my yard. A cobbler's son has no shoes. I'd never worked in my yard on a Saturday in decades. So,
but it was kind of like the changing of the chapter in your life, right? That's the emotion kind of behind it. And then, you know, you brought up, so for the record and people listening, Shane and I have known each other for a long time. I actually saw you rupture your Achilles one time playing soccer.
I tore my hamstring. The only time I've ever taken off running for that long. It was brutal. Yeah. It was the worst injury I've ever had. Hamstring.
Yeah. And we were playing soccer at one of the, at the Domain Fest in Las Vegas at some indoor place. It was just a group of us decided to play a soccer game and he hurt himself. And we've always been friendly through the years, but we've never really done a sale together and had a lot of conversations. Yeah. And then at the ICA event, we talked for like a half hour or 40 minutes about running and about the business and about all kinds of things. And then we decided to have for you to come on the show. You messaged me, say, hey, can I come on? I said, sure. And it was funny because at the ICA event, people said to me like, oh, you're doing, how do they put it? Someone said, you're doing a podcast similar to the one Shane does. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, well, his blog is called Uncomfortable. And I was like, I didn't even know that. And I actually didn't know. Like, I didn't say, oh, I'm just going to copy him. But if I knew that, I wouldn't have done it. And it's like, we're in the same small industry, but we're also, some people are in bubbles. And I've been more on the brokerage side in my life, in my business, than domain investing. And I'll be honest, like, I haven't really read your blog very often. I mean,
I think it's not what you do.
What'd you say?
It's not really what you do. It's not like you're going looking for closeout domains. That's not your thing.
No, it's not my specialty. And I know Josh, he's a great guy. You know, I think his story is great, being a firefighter and, you know, a domain investor. And he was telling me how he'd be like picking names off the list in the firehouse, waiting for a fire and being a domainer. And it's a really cool story that he has. And, you know, an Uncomfortable for me was I had in some people's eyes one of the most perfect jobs in the world, working as, you know, in a cool startup on an island, getting compensated a lot of money, you know, being part of a great team and great people and going to the beach on the weekends and doing those things. And I decided I needed more of a challenge and it was time to go. And when I resigned, I called Frank and talked to him about it. And when I hung up the phone, I looked at my wife and I said, what the fuck did I just do? And there was crying involved and there was emotions involved, but I knew that it was time to go on and kind of do my own thing and spread my own wings and get out there and put myself, as corny as it is, in an uncomfortable situation to make myself grow. And I did it when I joined Uniregistry because I had my own business before that and the opportunity came and that was leaving a good paying job and a good opportunity and success to put myself again in my, you know, out of my comfort zone. And I think if you're going to grow or want to accomplish anything, you got to do it. Right. And if I never wanted to do that, I could still be a broker working at CETO. And there's nothing wrong with that either, but I would still just be doing, you know, what they're doing, what I was doing there first, or selling mortgages when I got out of college. Right. And again, that's a great living, but I wanted more and I wanted to, you know, challenge myself more. And that's, you know, and then this as a podcast, I do get nervous before some of the episodes and I was nervous before I launched it. And I was worried about how people were going to perceive it and if they enjoy listening to it, or am I going to check the views like after we post this one and there's two and it's yours and mine, you know, but then it's like you do it and you're like, that wasn't so bad. You know, let's try something else, you know?
100%. But part of the thing that I always tell everybody is in order to make these uncomfortable decisions, we always have a base of somebody that loves us, right? Like, I know that if I failed, when I retired, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. But I know that my wife would be there for me. I know that my daughter, that no matter if I failed miserably or we didn't have enough money or it didn't go well, that I had a base of people that love me. And I know that sounds corny, but that's true. To really get better, you have to have this base of people that care about you because you have a place to fall. And that, so you can go get uncomfortable knowing that the it could go horribly wrong and it could be a terrible decision, or you could push, like in racing, you could push yourself too far, but you're going to come home and you're going to be fine. Like, you're going to still have people there that are still rooting for you. And that was always a good base for me to allow me to become more uncomfortable and to make harder decisions. And then teaching my daughter, I can't tell her to do something and not do it myself. Like, she's scared to death to go give a speech. Well, I can't tell her that she has to do it. And then at the same time, I'm not doing things like that, right? So by having a kid and trying to teach them, it shows you, you're telling them all these things you should be doing, right? That you should be. So yeah. I'm right there with you. Like, those are the moments that make us better. And that's always been my mantra. And that's that it's proven now. Like, I was listening to Huberman Labs. It is proven that those uncomfortable decisions build a part of your brain that makes decision-making, the decision-making part of your brain grows. And it's not made when you make decisions that aren't uncomfortable, that you want to. It's only made during the hard times. That's why David Goggins is who he is, because he's always doing, he's an animal, but it's a proven fact. And it's scientifically proven that you get better by doing things that you don't want to do.
I want an alarm clock that's him yelling at me in the morning to get going. I think that will
burn the boats. Or no, yeah. It's he has been motivating. Like, he's not I know he mentally is as troubled as a human being. Like, he's got demons. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt he about does. It. But at the same time, he's not wrong. Like, we are capable of way more than we think we are. But I do think it comes down. I'm really big about building a base of friends and people that care about me. I mean, I don't mind saying that Adam Strong said that I sometimes take things too hard. And he's not wrong. But what he doesn't know is I only take it hard from the people that I care about, right? If some random stranger says something on the internet, or that doesn't bother me at all. But if somebody I care about says something, yeah, it bothers me. And I probably take it too hard. But that's because that base is also the base that's driven me. My friends around me that root me on, that catch me if I fall. That's really, really important. People with that kind of base do great things. They think it's a loner mentality. Loners don't go real far. At some point, you can only go so far by yourself. It kind of goes back to our talk before. Your brokerage can only be so good with just you. Your company can only be so good with just you. It takes this giant group of people to really do amazing things. One person can do a ton of things.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think, first and foremost, you're absolutely right. My wife has been 100% supportive, you know, making the decision to go to Cayman. She didn't even come with me or even ever step foot on that island. And she's like, all right, I'm moving with you when you move. Supporting, leaving consistent income or not knowing and giving up a business to join Frank. He could have canned me 2 months in and moved back, and I had we had nothing, you know? And then starting the business, we had a beautiful house in Cayman. Our kids were in school there. Like, things were going, well, one of my kids was, not both, but like things, we had friends, like everything was the way that people dream. And I said, I don't want this anymore. So packed up the whole house. We moved in with friends. She supported that. The business was failing during COVID and the beginnings of it. You know, I was writing checks to make the company stay alive. She's supportive of that 100%, listening to me talk about those things. And then at the same time, on the flip side, right, is I have friends that are totally supportive of me that are outside of the business, that I talk to on a regular basis, that are cheering for me when I tell them that good things are happening in my life. And they're like, oh shit, what's going on? Are you okay? And then I also have some of the best friends I've ever made by being in this industry. And the funniest part is that some of those people are competitors of mine. Right. One that just texted me is Alan Dunn. My cell phone is off. He just texted me and said, is your phone working? Because obviously he's trying to call me, right? And Alan Dunn owns Name Corp. He's a broker. And then you said, you know, like, I want to go on the podcast, but I'm going to get into domain brokerage. We don't have to talk about it. But like, you know, we're becoming closer friends, and it's like, I'm fine with it. Yeah. You know, I'm fine with you talking about what you're going to go and do. And there's plenty of opportunity for all of us. And, you know, and I also think I also think it goes with saying in any business, and what I've learned over the years is, yeah, you can't do it yourself. And when I joined Frank, he said something to me that was interesting. He said, you're having a problem delegating the work, and it's almost like you're Hercules on one side of the ship with one giant oar and everybody else is on the other, and you're trying to pull, and they're doing the same amount of work and you're doing the same amount of work as they are, and you need to give people more work and more delegate more things to them and rely on those people to do and carry out those things. And with Saw.com in my business last year, my goal was to, since I launched this business, was not just to build a brokerage, but to build kind of another platform similar to a domain name sales, because I was part of that design and I had a feeling that it would vanish. And I realized that I can't do it all by myself. And obviously I've hired other brokers at this point. Some of them are better than me at doing brokerage, because I've been running this business and managing for the last, 4 years. I still make sales, but I'm not pumping the phone all day like they are, and I'm not as sharp as I used to be. But, I realized that I needed not just help on the sales side, but also on the tech side, and that you can't get there on your own, and just like with Uniregistry, Frank was the face of the company, but behind Frank was 120 other people working to a common goal. And it's like, and there you go. So you're right. I need people to help me emotionally. I need people to help me in business. And then I also need people, like the way I look at my friends, I got a friend who's like a financial planner. I've got a friend who's an accountant, and it's not by design. I got a friend who's a director in like middle management at a large company. And I've got other random friends in different, totally different industries, but it's almost like they're my board, board of advisors. And depending on like the situation I might find myself in, other than just talking about life, like a business issue, like talking to them helps me work it out from a different, perspective.
Your peers and your friends tend to be people that you admire, right? You don't find people that you're always having to pick up. Like there are going to be times that they need your help as well. But when it comes to intelligence and ethics and all that stuff, you generally tend to hang out with people that are equals or even aspire to be. I'm in the same boat as you. I live in a university town, so my friends are all doctors, but some are medical doctors and some are PhD doctors, but they're all of that level. I mean, my best friends are almost all medical doctors, because men my age that are running and doing things and driven tend to be driven in life, right? So they tend to be in professions that take being driven. And it's great because they're fascinated by my stories of domains or in our conferences, right? When we had our crazy conferences, I'd come home and tell them those stories and they'd be like, that is amazing, because they don't get to do that kind of stuff. And then at the same time, I'll talk to the tech people and they're fascinated by plants. Like, I have a house plant. Can you tell me how to help? Like, they're fascinated by the patience that I have with growing flowers. So it's just been this, like you said, it's like this beautiful thing. And I think the best leaders acknowledge all the things that you've said, right? You don't always get straight there, but the best leaders, they are the face, and they have to be a leader and they have to step forward. But leading is also creating those opportunities. We had talked about this earlier, creating the opportunities for those around you. Your job as a leader is to create opportunities for those that you work with. And so it's not about you. Again, I say this, it's like children. It's not about you. And I don't mean to say that employees are children, but you are their leader. Leaders provide for them, leaders guide them, leaders support them, and leaders give them opportunity. And opportunity is all that anybody can ask. Humans only want two things: to stay busy and opportunity. That's really all they want. They want to stay busy. People think people are lazy. That's bullshit. Everybody wants to be busy. It may be busy in something that you don't want them to be busy in, but in general, they do want to be. An employee loves to have things to do and organized things to do. They don't want to just say, here's a book, go do something. No, they want a little bit of guidance, and they want, but that's leadership, and not everybody's meant to be a leader. I look at somebody that's not doing a good job, and I just said, they're just not a leader. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're not all born leaders. But COVID for me taught me that I was a leader. Like when COVID came and the trouble came, I just felt amazing. Like I felt I'm going to get our company through this. I felt that it was like nothing I've ever experienced. I was so happy to have that. And my wife, I go, why am I so excited about COVID? She's like, this is a chance for you to be a leader. This is a chance for you to do things and get people through this. And that's, leaders love those type of opportunities. Here's the downside. When it was all over, you just come down. Like once I had a great COVID because our sales were double. You know, everybody was gardening. Everybody was doing everything that I had to offer they wanted. But when it was over, it's kind of the band stops playing. Then we're back to normal. Then we're everything. And it's just not as exciting. So I struggled almost emotionally, which is, you can't tell anybody that because everybody else is like, I finally get to fucking go out. Sorry, my language, but I finally get to go eat. And I get to, my business was, I was dying. I financially was getting killed. And I'm the opposite. I was like, I was making so much money. I'm actually coming down from that. So it was a very difficult time. But to roll that back into what you said, yeah, I mean, that's, you have to learn to be a leader. You have to learn to be a manager. You have to, it's just part of growing up and becoming better at what you do. Is Frank wasn't wrong. You're probably doing exactly what he said. I've done the same thing. My father told me that over and over, but I don't always listen to him because he was my father. It's hard to have your father as your boss. That's a very difficult situation.
Yeah, I agree, you know, 100%. So let's talk about what your future plans are and getting yourself a little more uncomfortable is you're going to be launching your own domain brokerage in the very near future. What are you going to call it?
Well, I don't know what I don't know. I know, here's, let's put it this way. I know I want to do domain brokerage. I know.
Okay.
I do enjoy outbound sales. Like I hate to put it this way, but it's almost like a game. You have this, you know, nobody's looking for your email, right? You have a domain name and the people that you're trying to reach aren't looking for your domain at that time. Like you're trying to quote convince them, or you're trying to reach out people that it could work out with well. And I think that's exciting. Like I do like it. It's a talent. I wasn't very good at it, and I'm probably still not very good at it, but I do like that prospect of matching great companies with domains that can multiply the efforts that they have. And that's a tough job. That's a tough job. And it can't be spammy. Spam is a huge problem. But essentially, that outbound is, I really enjoy that part of it. And I love the negotiation part. I love, and I said this to Drew on Domain Sherpa quite often, I love selling expensive domain names, but I love the businesses that are able to afford them and how they're going to utilize them. Like that's what I think, that's, I love that story. I love that. That's what the podcast that I was doing when I was doing Uncomfortable, it was talking to people that were building businesses, because I want to know how you can afford $1 million domain. What have you done and what have you created and what are your skill sets and what are your thought process of being able to form a company that can afford $1 million domain? And once you've bought that domain, how are you going to make that $1 million pay off? Because it's not just going to be a little thing you stick at the top of your website, right? It's more to it than that. So I love that conversation and I want to have more of those conversations. I want to talk to serial entrepreneurs that come back and say, Shane, that worked out great. I'm looking for something in the skateboard. You know, I want that to happen because I know serial entrepreneurs, once they've figured out domain names, they're addicted. They want to come back and do more things with domain names because they know the effect it has. So that's my future. Yeah. That's what I want to build my own portfolio up and continue to grow and add more domains. Now that I can spend a little more time hunting, I'd like to do that. And then I want to be in the domain business, plain and simple, whatever that entails. I want to be in that business. That's what I want to do for a living, is I want to buy and sell domain names, utilize domain names, everything about that. I want to be part of it. So that's kind of my future. What that holds, I'm not quite sure. You know, I've tried out some things, some have worked, some haven't, and I'll just keep building on that. But I know that if I do work, I do want to work with a team, and I want to work with a team that is a team, just like we talked about before. I'm not the leader, I want the leader to be someone that makes everybody better, right? That's what we're looking for. I'm too old to have anything but, right? I'm too old to do anything but something I really love and enjoy. And that doesn't mean every second. That doesn't mean every minute's going to be enjoyable. Uncomfortable, as we said, has to be part of it.
Yeah.
But in general, I'm 50, going to be 55 years old. I want to go out in these last 20 years and have a hell of a time, make some money, do great things with great people. That's plain and simple if I was going to put it in a nutshell.
What CRM are you planning on using?
Pardon me?
What CRM are you planning on using?
I think pretty much everybody does the same thing, right? I think everybody pretty much uses like an Apollo-based for emails. They use LinkedIn Sales Navigator is kind of a contact point and a searching point. And then as far as the notes, everybody uses a little bit of different, you know, how they keep their notes and their... But yeah, I think everybody uses the same thing. I know everybody likes to pretend that they have something special, but everybody pretty much uses the same two or three people to find source contacts. And then some people, I'm a big builder of, when I say proprietary tools, having tech build stuff that pretty much uses the information we get from everybody else and feeds it into a way that we can use it where we're comfortable, right? Like that's mm-hmm. That's what we do.
Yeah. And I mean, we use, as a company, we do use Apollo. We find the being able to find contacts. And if you want to put them into like an email campaign, Apollo is good for that. It's a confusing website with so many bells and whistles and things. It's like, there's just so much going on it. And it's sometimes hard to navigate. But as a CRM, we use like close.com because we like that one because you can create as many custom fields as you want. You can create and track all of the leads that you're working on. So you could export the leads from Apollo in there, or you could take, you know, opportunities out of Sales Navigator, and then it integrates with Zapier. And then do you know what Zapier is?
I don't think I've seen it, but I've never used it. No, I'm not familiar with it.
So with Zapier, you can so instead of you paying someone for APIs, you go on Zapier and you can search like whatever services you need, and Zapier connects to Close, and then you can have it do, you know, different things. So like one of the things
it's like a plug-in for APIs. It's like a plug-in.
And so like Close is on Zapier. And then like one of the products we use is like IP Stack. So then when someone inquires to our website on a lead, they inquire, we got the IP address, then Zapier hits IP Stack, and then it tells us where the person's located and puts it in the lead in the
Super
CRM.
Smart.
Right. Or if you want like different data sets, or if somebody unsubscribes from an email, it updates it, removes the email address, like, and it does all different things. So when I started the business where I was used to this robust system of Uniregistry domain name sales that we built over 7 years, I had nothing.
Yeah.
Right. And so I used.
You knew what you wanted to do. You just didn't know how to get there.
Well, I don't know how to write a line of code.
No, but you knew what you wanted it to do. You just had no way of creating that.
No way. But I also didn't have any time because I needed to get something going and get it going fast because I needed to start getting going with the business. So then Zapier allowed me to do kind of like backyard mechanic work, you know, to make my system
paint
work
by numbers
in, you know, short term. And as you get bigger, you start to replace Zapier in different areas because it can get expensive because you buy credits every month. Right. But like, if I were to start another domain brokerage or any sales platform, and I didn't want to spend a lot in development, I would use Close, set up my fields, and then use Zapier to help enrich. That's the word they use, enrich the data in some way. And then you can do different, you know, fun stuff with it. Sales Navigator is not bad. I find what the unfortunate thing these days with LinkedIn is a lot of people are automating their communications in LinkedIn. And now a lot of the experience on LinkedIn for me is I just get a lot of trash, people messaging me constantly about stuff. Yeah. And you're like, I try to respond to everybody and check it. And you're like, I'm not interested. And they just keep writing to you. Like, and you know, it's automated. Yeah. And it's just like, dude, like, please, like, respect, you know, and what they're doing is they're ruining LinkedIn because other people that we want to contact are going to stop responding to everybody, right? It's not going to be a useful tool.
Yeah, and then, you get thrown in the mass spam. So you look just like spam,
Yeah, just trash. And then we're just not worth it, right? And you know, the more that time goes on, when you're trying to do an acquisition for somebody, you know, the who has been really privatized over the last, you know, 8 or 10 years. So the who is history is starting to fade out. It's not as accurate as it used to be. But if you do find that nugget and you figure out that this is the owner or possible owner of the domain name on LinkedIn and you find them, you know, the odds of them answering, it seems to be getting a little less as time's going on. And I have a sense that when I started using LinkedIn back in 2002, if I messaged you on LinkedIn, I would usually, I think it was like a 90% response rate of people like, how are you? You know, like there was always, but now I feel like it's starting, you know, it's going down. And I don't know if LinkedIn's doing enough to block automated folks and people from areas of, like, I don't know, certain types of
services. I'm starting to get sequences in LinkedIn. Like, that's not something that I didn't use LinkedIn because I didn't, in the nursery business, my stuff was local and regional. I just didn't need those kind of contacts. Like, it wasn't something that I needed. That's my awards are like my 1976 basketball awards when I was seven. Like, nobody cares. But I'm starting to get sequences like, hey, would you like a virtual cup of coffee? And then I don't, and then another one comes. So that automation, that never happened. Like, that now.
Yeah, so that's what I'm talking about. It's happening more and more and more. And we've actually tried it as a business, and I was like, this is ridiculous. Let's just stop. You know, like, I don't
yeah,
really
no,
like
nobody
myself.
Wants that. I mean, that the honest truth about all email is it's spam, right? Like, outbound in our industry is officially spam. Nobody asked for the email of you trying to sell a domain. So you have to remember that when you're reaching out to people, whether it's LinkedIn or email. Officially, by definition, us contacting you is spam. Now, we can say, hey, it's a business thing, but it was they didn't ask for us to contact us. They had no interest going in. So you kind of have to keep that in mind and be professional and under, you know, when you approach someone that it's in earnest, and no is as good an answer as yes, right? So at least they respond. But I always, in my LinkedIn, I put my personal details. There's a picture of my family, my dog, so that if you get something from me, I'm hoping they at least look at me and go, this seems like a normal person. Like, seems like I could call this guy any day and get him on the phone. Like, this is not a normal looking guy that you would expect. So I try and really personalize and make everybody feel, whether they've gotten an email from me or any kind of contact, that this guy's only reaching me because he has something that he thinks I could use. So I'll give him the time. So that's the hopes. Like, that's a goal. I'm new to this. I have tons to learn. I am not a professional at domain brokerage, but I feel like I'm a professional when it comes to understanding businesses and I like understanding the value. So I'll get better at what I do. One thing I do think that's catching everybody off guard is email. We had a nice little discussion before, but email, Google's not messing around with spam anymore. Like, everything has to be perfect or they're not letting things through. Like, email is getting knocked hard. Everything has to match up. And it's good from a domain owner. Nobody's going to spoof you right now. If you spoof it, it's not getting through. But if you spam, buzzwords are gone. Like, all those words that people were amazing writers, done. You can't write like that anymore. It won't make it through spam. So you got to cut to the point or the chase right now. You got to keep it pretty clean on how you write.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. But what's amazing is if I opened up my email right now, there's going to be in my other folder or promotions folder a ton of emails, right? And I get probably 50 or 60 of these a day. And then I also get constantly are the fake DocuSigns and the fake the fake emails from my employees saying I want to update my bank details for payroll. Mm-hmm. I get those all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's wild the amount of fraud that's happening, you know?
Yeah, and that also again, gets through. They're going to be one step ahead of everything. Like, that's the thing is, you know, when I look at the things that get through, the first thing I look through is I look at the email to see how it got through. Like, what did they do? What can I use from those guys that'll help me get through? Like, that's what I, that's the first thing that I go, why are he getting through and I can't get a nice email through? So I try and look and see what they did to make it pass all the spam tests that I have going on. So in some cases, I kind of like getting some of them so I can learn from what are they doing.
I've heard that one of the moves that someone who's like a scammer would buy a name in auction that was a developed site. And that site had a good reputation of sending emails to their customers. And so they'll pound that until it gets blocked and then it closes and they trash that name and buy another or buy a bunch and just 100%.
Domains. Yeah, that's, it is domain reputation. And that's why it's difficult to start a new company with a new domain. You have to warm up the email. Like, you've got to give it months and months and months of warm up.
Oh yeah.
That's why they have warm up services. I mean, that's why they do it, because in order to get an email and a domain, it has to show activity, and you can't start it off by emailing customers.
Yeah. But I also think, you know, what I think is, when your email gets through, then the odds of them responding and then them responding and then it meeting, like, whatever their plans are, you have no idea what's going on the other side. And then them giving you the opportunity for a phone call, or them not giving you the opportunity for a phone call and just saying how much, you know, and then not responding and, or, you know, saying they're not interested. I mean, I think it's really like you're just dragging, you know, you're dragging your net around the ocean. And I also found that we've been in a situation, I've personally been in a situation, and others in my company have been in a situation where some of these massive companies say either the domain isn't for sale or they're not interested in buying it. And we've gotten the domain by going to somebody else, and we've sold the domain to somebody else in the company, where other times we've continued to pursue it and then got an email back from the lawyer saying, you better stop. You know, it's like, it's hard from our point of view too, because sometimes there's mixed signals, you know. And then I also think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I've had domains where I'll email it. I'll email and say it's not for sale. And then I'll get an email from a totally different person that says, hey, I heard from so-and-so that you were looking at the domain. What were you thinking of offering? I'm thinking, hold on, are two people in the company? Like, somebody's got to make this decision. And then when I ask the price, it's multiple six figures. And then another domainer 2 months later buys it for a tenth of that from that company. Like, yeah, I'm like, it's like a big company. Everybody, you know, who's making that call to sell that domain? It's hard getting the right person that can actually make the efficient call.
Yeah. Timing is sometimes the essence of life. Right. And, you know, one of the things that I find is that, you know, we offer our services and we've emailed companies about buying domains and it's, you know, radio silence, no response. And I've had it where we're saying, hey, you should buy this name. It would be a great fit for your company. Right. Radio silence, call in, nobody answers, nobody gets back to us. We give up after a period of time. And I've been referred to somebody at that same company who says they want to buy this name. Would you like to represent us to go and acquire it? And I know that we've emailed them a bunch of times. We've called them a bunch of times and they're acting like this is a new thing and they've never considered buying this. And it's just weird how the timing, and sometimes they just, for some reason, they didn't acknowledge your emails, even though we're spending a lot of time and energy making sure our deliverability rates are good and things like that. So, you know, it's just
sometimes luck of the draw is that's how it works, right? You know, even when you have a domain or you buy a domain and then all of a sudden you sold it, and the person that sold it, because it hadn't had an offer in 5 years, then all of a sudden you buy the name and sell it. And they're like, that's just how life is. Like, there's nothing you can do about that stuff. You have to do what you can control and keep working after it. And, but you know, in our industry, we only get paid when we sell domains or buy domains or take actions. Like, that's the only thing. All the rest of the work doesn't get paid. Like, you're not getting a salary. It's commission and you have to earn it. And I'm hoping, and I found that it all evens out, right? You're going to get those sales that you barely did any work and it falls into your lap. And then there's going to be other ones where you work your ass off and really nothing comes of it. So you just have to hope that overall, when it's all said and done, that it's worth your time. And it usually is, right? Like most of us have done very well yeah. over the years. But in any individual case, if you try and say that it happened because of X or Y, maybe it did. Sometimes it's
Yeah, I mean, I think the X and Y is that you create a process and a formula and you stick with it and you consistently mm-hmm. stick with it and work hard at it every day, and that there will be some level of consistency, but you got to realize you got to kiss a lot of frogs before yeah. one turns into, you know, a sale. And you're right. Some of the sales don't require as much effort and others, you know, blow up and you've worked harder on that and have been had better sales calls than you ever have. And for whatever reason, something changes that is out of your control. You know, we sell names that some of the salespeople started working on 2 years ago, 3 years ago that work for me right now, you know, and or 4 years ago, and that they are now, the company is now in a position to buy it. Or, you know, they said, what's the price? Okay, that's good, but we got to talk about it. They keep delaying, and then they call and say, okay, I want to buy this. Other situations, the deals blow up or they don't have the money to buy or whatever happens, you know. And then I just had a gentleman call me from a name that I sold, I think, like 5 or 6 years ago that said, hey, Jeff, how you been? I'm like, great. How are you? Nice to talk to you. He's like, oh, I moved to a new opportunity and we want to buy this. Can you help us? Yep. Oh, absolutely. You know, what are your feelings? What do you think it's going to cost? And I quickly give him like a rundown as to what I think it might cost and who I think the owner is and what I think's happening with it and why I think the name's worth what it's worth. And he's like, okay, you know, send me an agreement. Let's get cooking. And I did. And so, you know, it's a weird business, you know, and I think a lot of it for me is a lot is referrals now from me personally and for a lot of the salespeople as well that, you know, you can live off of those and do well, but then obviously new business comes in. We pay a lot of money in Google Ads and have sellers that point their names at us too, that kind of create that, you know, that consistency. There's also, again, that process and that you got to stick with in sales, you know, and
you've been doing it a long time. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear that something takes years and years to be successful, but that's the reality. And especially in domain investing, it takes a long time to build a base. And that referral you got was based on years of experience and years of relationships. And those will multiply you've gotten a point where they keep calling you or they tell a friend, hey, Jeff is the one who got it. Why don't you give him a call? And that just takes a long time to do that. It's in the beginning for a new person like myself, it's pretty hungry. Like you could go a year without having much income because you just don't have a lot of domains under management. You get, you know, it's hard. It's a hard go in the beginning, but once you get going, then you get going and you're fine.
I think you going out there and launching your own brokerage though, I think you know the hardest part, and that's the domain industry.
Yeah.
Already. Right. And understanding valuation, being able to explain it to people, being able to explain the escrow process, being able to explain transfers, being able to overcome objections about domains aren't useful anymore, being able to back them up with legitimate stories. Yeah. You know, when I first launched this business, my biggest problem was when I told a story about a success I had, I always had to talk about another company.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I couldn't talk about my own because I didn't sell shit yet. Right. Yeah. But you know, you as yourself, as a lone wolf doing it, you can, and being someone who's been a writer in the industry for years and being a contributor to it, what you say has weight and easily can be backed up, right? And I think you already have that. And when I used to hire brand new salespeople, I would say, if you immerse yourself in the material and you use all of the resources we give you and learn from those around you, in six months, you'll be good enough to put yourself in situations that you'll probably get yourself in some trouble and put yourself in some weird, like, and make some big mistakes, which is great. And then in 12 months, you'll be relatively dangerous, you know, and that's when you're really going to start to have like a pipeline that's building and potential repeat customers. And then also people that you spoke to this month one, that are finally come back with that funding, or they're going to come back with a new offer, or they're going to call you and say, can you help me acquire something else? And that's going to multiply and snowball and snowball and snowball. And then over the years, some of the snowball you don't even realize you have anymore, because these are people that might have vanished from your life years ago, or it's a friend who calls you and says, I told so-and-so about you, he needs you, and now you're in with them, you know? And I think you'll do fine, you know, and getting going. And it really doesn't take much for you to get a full day's work out of it, especially you can supplement with your own inventory of great names when you're, slow.
That's a great thing is it's funny, as much as I talk, I generally don't share any of my sales or my purchases. I'm doing fine. Like I'll make over $250,000 in profit in 2024 is my goal in my own inventory of profit. Now I try and roll that back into mains, but I can live on that. Like I'm fine. Like
it's, I hope so.
That's not going to be a problem. I think, you know, buying and selling, I do say this, you know, taking a percentage of a domain and selling it is great. But what's really great is buying and selling your own domain where you get to keep it all. Like that's really nice, especially when you have six figure domains and, you know, I do enjoy that part too. It's good negotiating your own when you have to turn to the owner and all you have to do is talk to yourself, whether the owner is going to take it.
It also can get very emotional for you as well when it becomes high pressure.
I'm in love with nothing. That's the thing is I wouldn't sell my daughter or my wife. But other than that, like I've never worn a jersey of a player in my life. I would never put another person's name. Yeah, but
just
that's true. Now I will say Michael Jordan. No, that's true. That's a very ironic. Michael Jordan has been like, when I lived in North Carolina, Michael Jordan went to North Carolina. We had to move away. I was so disappointed. I moved to Chicago. Michael Jordan gets drafted. So I watched all through grade school or junior high, Michael Jordan. Then I moved to Chicago and I go to all his games in 86, 87, 88, 89. I live all the way through the 90s. I go to Alabama. What does he do? He becomes a Birmingham Baron and goes to play baseball right down the road from me.
So did you go watch him?
Absolutely. So I will say this man, I have seen Michael Jordan more than any human other than my family. I mean, I've seen him thousands of times. So I will take all that back. You're right. There is one person that like, it's just like, I grew up with him. Like he's always been there. No matter where I've lived, Michael Jordan has been there. But other than that, like I wouldn't say I'd sell my dog, but you know what I mean? Like my domain name,
I hear you.
I am not in love with any of that. They are domain names. I'll sell it. I'll sell anything. I sell my car. No problem. If a guy comes on the street and gives me enough for my Bronco, I'll sell it.
You're gone.
It doesn't matter. It's just,
I think in this industry though, I find that there's not many people that can do both, be great at domain investing and a good domain broker for themselves. Right. There's usually people that are really good at, you know, building a nice catalog.
I think Drew, you know, I'm good friends with Drew. I really think the world of Drew and we all have different personalities, but I love it. Like I mean, he's just the kind of guy I have a lot of friends that are just like him that are aggressive and go-getters, but he's done a good job of having his own portfolio and other people's names. And he is,
I agree.
And he's in the same boat as I said before. Like, you know, I love selling other people's names. I love premium assets are premium assets. I don't care if they're mine or yours, but I'd rather they be mine. I'd rather they be mine. So who wouldn't? So, you know, he's very realistic. And so I appreciate that. And so it is kind of my business model is you have to respect your clients. Like you have to respect their names and you can't push your names in front of them. You have to objectively somehow figure out what's best for your client. And you can't say my name is best. It may be, but fortunately, if your quality is good enough, you're not putting junk in front of them, right? Like if I put a great four letter or something, I'm not going to have anything. But if you have some two letters and one word, it's like that's a little different. He has good stuff to put.
I think the thing is that if I had this happen when we were buying our house, we had a great realtor, a nice woman. We were looking to buy a house in Florida. She goes, I have an opportunity for you, but I need to tell you up front, there's a catch. And I was like, okay, let's go. You know, does it come with a timeshare I got to buy or like, what's this ridiculous catch? She goes, the owner of the house is a good friend of mine, and she's my neighbor. And I'm like, so what? And she's like, well, you're going to live next to me, and it's a good friend of mine. So, you know, I'm letting you know ahead of time that there is a relationship between myself and the owner of this house. And the house wasn't listed
to by law.
But she disclosed it. And I feel that even though we're not required by law, that if there was a name that I felt someone who hired me to help them find a name was one of mine that I thought they could benefit from, I would say, I don't usually do this, but based on what you said, this is a domain that I own, or my company owns, or my wife owns, and I think it fits. And this is the price that I want for it. If you don't like it, I'm never going to talk about it again.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. And as long as you do that, I think it's fine.
Yeah. No,
but if you're, I if think you're it's putting more five more they don't know about, geez, you know, that
but
yours,
I think on homes, I've never understood how they can represent the buy and the sell side. Like it's, that's tough. Like when a real estate agent has a home and they're representing the seller and the buyer, there's a huge conflict of interest in getting to the best price. I think
the thing is, a lot of realtors I've met in the last few years, there's some great realtors that I've met and have worked with, but in other cases, some are just saying, okay, what do you want to offer? And they just put it on the offer sheet and just email it. Like there isn't the negotiating going on as much as it used to be. And like, you know,
that
as much.
True. And I think I mean, the market is a little different.
Yeah, the market has been so hot that there's no, like, if you really wanted to put the screws to somebody, you can't, because then they just have another five families come in and buy the house and you're out.
But around here, you can still negotiate, and it's hard. My realtor can't give me they can't even tell me, like, if I want to offer a normal realtor, if it's just the buy side, they would say, I think we could go in and do this, but they can't do that because they know what the other side is. So they can't really say anything. They really get
to that's true. So then they're useless.
There's no point in having. So if I have somebody on the sell side, I get a lawyer for the buy side. That's what I do. I can't have it as the same side, and they want both sides because they commission on both. But so I found that that's a conflict of interest. Because they can't help me at all on the buy side. They can show me houses, but we have Zillow. We have so many tools now. I don't need to drive around with Maggie in her four-door and have her show me the houses. Like, it doesn't have to happen. Like I can virtually look at most of the houses and we'll go do a walkthrough after I've chosen through. Before I had to go through 10 houses. I don't have to go through 10. Maggie can just show me the last house that I'm interested in. But yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, and these are all the things that that we're getting better at, and the ethical choices, that's all part of what we do, right? And some are better at it than others. But, you know, there's people that I, you know, respect, you know, yourself. Everybody, we don't always get to all talk, but we all know who each other are. If you've been doing it this long, you have to be doing something right, right? Like people that have been doing it for decades can't be completely corrupt and immoral.
I agree. And I've done co-brokerage deals with Drew. Drew actually grew up about 40 minutes from where I grew up. And I know a couple of his friends that he grew up with, like in similar circles of people. So it's kind of strange that, you know, I know a guy that used to be in the fish business with Drew. So, you know, him and I have had some calls where we're negotiating with each other and teasing each other and making fun of each other and having some laughs. And I like him a lot. I think he's a great guy. I think he's extremely talented salesperson. And you're right. He's one of those people that can be the investor and can be the broker. You know, me on the other hand, I've sat and I've read lists like yours and I'm bored to tears and I can't stand sitting there and doing it every morning and sitting in an auction and making those bids every day and then waiting for them to end or hemming and hawing or should I make another bid? And if I were to go and become serious about it, I would probably automate it a bit more where I would put in the highest bid. And if I win, I win. If I don't, I don't.
Yeah.
And just,
you'll use an API all the, you know, like
all day.
That hike that we took in Vegas, you know, there was a hike during the conference and I'm walking with Mike Ambrose, who is one of the founders of .xyz, him and Daniel Nagari. And Mike is generally just one hike, I can see how nice he is. You know, I'm with Aaron Wilkin, Mike Ambrose, and Stephen Kennedy. Literally three of the nicest guys in all the industry.
Yeah, they're all three great guys, and they're all brilliant.
They're all so smart. Like, it was an honor to walk and hike for 4 hours. And I can't think of a better business meeting than 4 hours up a mountain, right? Like, you're just talking, looking ahead. You don't have to worry about eye contact. Like, I don't always make great eye contact. And so this is a perfect situation where I need to watch my feet anyway. So talking to those guys, and I will say there's something about having Stephen Kennedy sell six names on the 4 hour hike. Like, you can hear his email, pring, selling. And Mike is 11. You know, Mike has 500,000 or more names, and Stephen has, I don't know, 100,000 or something. But there is something about cash flow of having those guys sell six names during that process that you're like, man, I would love to have that. But I also know how hard they worked and how, like, Stephen started with one or two names and built that all over since I started. He was in high school when I started. So I respect the hell out of all those guys because I know they didn't all start with that. They all started with nothing and built that through rolling it and investing and learning their skill set. And I appreciate that model too. So that's why you asked me what I want to do, I appreciate all the models of making money in domain investing. And I'll probably explore all of them as part of what I do. I just want to sell domain names. That's what it comes down to. Mine, yours, whatever it is. I love domain names. I love the business. But I also like crypto and blockchain. Like, I understand that part of technology too. That technology is very important and there's a lot of opportunity there. So I incorporate that. I also, you know, understand the value, like you said, of the tools. And, you know, at DSAD, we look like a simple, boring website, but Travis on the back end has so many tools and links, and he's built all these things custom coding so that we can do things quicker and faster. That's a very important part of all we do. Every domain investor who has anything has APIs and tools built out for them to make their day more managed, quicker, and more efficient. And that's,
well, yeah, you can do it all manually. You'll lose your mind day after day after day. And by the time it's time to evaluate the names, you're already tired and over it, you know? And then there's also those that have the bots that are just pretty much doing all the bidding as well, right?
So, well, and that's what the API is. You go ahead and put all your information up ahead of time, and your bot slowly puts it to bid. So, you know, that's what APIs are all about. You should. Like, if you're in the domain business, you really have to have a bot doing your work. We joke about Yanni's bot, like, always being honest, but we all know, I can tell the huge domains bot, I can tell Steven's bot, I can tell everybody's bot. Like, and I also know, like, what the ranges are. Like, the average acquisition for me is $380. Like, I know that's what it is. And then I talk to other people and that's about it. By the time you do your closeouts and then your larger price names, when you average it, I can tell the people listening to this, if you participate daily on the expired auctions and you get all kinds of names, you're going to average $380 to $420 a domain if you're at all ranges. So that's what you expect. If you're going to put 1,000 names, you want to add 1,000 names this year, expect to spend $400,000 if you're going to be in that game. So,
I mean, that's not a big sign. That's a big investment, and that's a lot of choices, you know, and then you get to carry
it. Like, I'm going to hand register. If you're going to hand register, you're not going to have as good a quality of names. You have to be a mix of, you know, certain type of names that sell, and that is all over the board. And they're more expensive every day, right? Like, names that were for $50 go for $500. It's a different ball game. I mean, I bought Winterline, Winterline. That name would have cost me a couple $100s. Just as a cool brand, it was $1,000. It cost me $1,000 to add Winterline. I just picked it up at NameJet. So, you know, those are the.
What do you like about Winter? What do you like about Winterline so much?
Winterline is just a good. I like to buy names that are two known, easy to spell words that make a good brand. It's a good brandable type name. It'll sell for $8,900 or something. And it exudes like outdoors and clothing, and it could be technology. Those are just the kind of names that I like to add. Those kind of brands. Now, am I going to reach out and outbound that to somebody? No. That's going to be a decision where somebody's coming up with a naming to do that. There's no company's name that. Like, I'm not going onto Crunchbase and finding Winterline. That's what we all do. When we're looking for it, we look for existing. But if you go and there's a Crunchbase list of 30 people that have the name in a .com, you're not spending $1,000 to get that name. It's not going to be a $1,000 domain.
No.
So it's all relative when it comes down to it. So, and then you have people like Ike who've been doing things like that for, or Josh, sorry, Josh Eisenhower that we talked about. You know, he's up to whatever, 10 or 15,000 names when he was buying those when they were $100 and $50. And now he's killing it. You know, now he's selling lots of those names. So it's all relative. You can still make a lot of money entering it. It just costs more money to enter. So that's the thing.
Yeah. And I know another investor that sold his portfolio to GoDaddy. I'll keep his name confidential, but he said the majority of his portfolio he bought in GoDaddy closeouts.
Yep.
And he said it was funny to sell a lot of it back to GoDaddy. He had a good laugh about that. At, you know, they could have kept them all for themselves.
It's an appreciating asset, right? That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's, domains are appreciating asset. And so far we have proven that 100% that .coms that are solid, quote, however you determine that, have been appreciating. And definitely in the auctions, no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, how can people get a hold of you? I know they can go to dsad.com, but how else can they get a hold of you if they have any questions?
I just have an easy, I have domain. Well, Twitter's a good one. I just have my name. It's at Shane Coltra. I have, I'm pretty present there. And then you're welcome to email me. I get plenty of email at domainshane@gmail.com. I keep it at a nice, easy Gmail for all that. I opened up my DMs on Twitter. I don't know if I should have or not, but I got 100 DMs yesterday, just people asking about names. And I will say this, a person asked me about a name that he had. And I said, it's not a good name. It's a matter of fact, it's a trademarked name. And I said, you just can't have trademarks. And he said, well, what about this? And it had an offer from GoDaddy for $1,000. And I go, oh, well, I would definitely not counter too much. You're playing with fire. It's a trademark. I highly don't recommend it. He said, well, okay, let's pretend it's not a trademark. What would you do? And I'm like, well, in that quality, I'd probably come back at $2,500. He's like, let me think about it. I'm not exaggerating. 30 seconds later, he goes, I just got this email. It's 10 minutes after. They're offering $4,000. I'm like, what's the span? He goes, 10 minutes. And I said, this is trademarked, but it is a big trademark. So I said, all right, this is fire. Like, I would say just take it normally. This is not how domains work. You shouldn't do it at all. But just put $10,000 in and just go. And 3 seconds later, taken. We accept it. It's more than we want to pay, $10,000. So in the course of like 8-minute DM that I never would have owned for a name that I thought was horrible and unethical when it comes to squatting, he sold for $10,000.
Bet you in the next week or so, you're going to see a marketing campaign with that on it somewhere, or there's going to be something on it.
This one is so bad. I cannot imagine. I'll tell you after the show. There's no way. It's a protection name. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, really?
It's a but there's no way.
They know they could file and win, right?
Yeah,
or they could have just sent a cease and desist and probably could have gotten the name. But I think them getting it quickly was more important than getting it the other way. You know, I always felt, and talking to John Berryhill, that like between $3,000 and $5,000 is the magic number, because that's what it costs to file. Exactly. But there's no, it's 100% chance of a win if you sell it to them for $3,000 or $5,000, right? Yeah. And they don't have to wait 2 months to get the name, and it's just done.
It's just easier for them,
But yeah, it's not so a making that model. Offer makes sense.
It's not, you know, I told him, he goes, I should do this for a lot of names. I go, take this money and enjoy the luck of the draw, but this is not a business model. Take the money if you want to.
No, it's not a business model.
Yeah. So, but the DMs did make it more interesting. Pardon me?
Is he in the United States?
I don't know. He didn't have a U or a Z instead of an S kind of thing. So I don't know, because it was during the day. But I do.
Yeah,
and his English was fine. So I'm not quite sure. But the DMs did get a little overwhelming. But I do like talking domains to a point. Like, It gets to be a little bit much with all the offers, but every once in a while something will come through where you'll be able to have an interesting conversation and learn more and make, you know, people don't forget when you help them, right? I mean, that'll kind of tie this all up. When you, if you do everything you do just to make money, life's going to not be too good. So if you help somebody and you can take 5 minutes of your day, you can't do it for everybody, but I do feel like just answering that email, that guy that made $10,000, he won't forget me. Like he will, maybe he becomes
a big company owner. No way. You're part of the story now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That hopefully the life-changing amount of money for him.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was worth it for me. So all those other 99 DMs that kind of sucked, we're good now. Like it made it worth it. So that's why I appreciate being on here and you giving me a voice and Drew on Domain Sherpa, letting me be on that. I truly enjoy that. I love talking about domains and being part of it. And I think we're all really fortunate that the houses that we have or the little things that we have, they've been purchased through domains. That's crazy. It's just amazing. When you tell somebody that the things I have are made from selling domains, only we truly understand what that is and how crazy that is. So
it is. And I'm lucky. Like all of my wealth, all of the things I have are really from domains. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing this for 14 years now. So the money I had before was a lot less than what I have now. So I would say the percentages are much smaller and I'm definitely grateful for what this industry has done.
Yeah. I think it's great.
Yeah. All right, Shane. Well, hey, thanks for having us. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. We've covered a lot of material. I can't believe it's been an hour and 40 minutes. I don't know if people are going
to
laugh.
Yeah, I know. I tend to run long. Sorry about that, everybody. You can that's okay. A couple runs.
No, that's great. You know, and we'll definitely have you on again. And, you know, I think it'll be fun to potentially have some others on at the same time. Brooke wanted to come on. We were joking.
Yeah, I love Brooke.
Like
yeah.
My Robin. She's like my Robin Quivers to add some more balance to the conversation. So maybe she'll come on and we'll have you on again in the near future. 100%. So thanks again. And until next time.
All right. Thanks again.
To you soon.